Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Any interview with Dr. Larry Norton is an intellectual roller coaster ride that invariably leads into new pockets of oncologic knowledge and theory, and my most recent chat with the Dose Dense King was no exception. To begin, Dr. Norton discussed the new concept of cancer pathogenesis that flips conventional oncologic logic on its ear.
As you know, we've been very interested in Gompertzian growth for decades. And the Gompertzian growth model, in addition to being interesting in and of itself, clearly has clinical applications. And the whole concept of dose density or the scheduling of drugs being as or sometimes more important than dose level, that whole concept is dependent upon the fact that tumors grow in this Gompertzian fashion where they start to grow exponentially but eventually tail off and try to reach a plateau phase. By the way, there have been no counterexamples to this, that everything that's ever been observed to grow in nature, including cancers, follows this kind of growth pattern. And that itself has been very intriguing because the question has always been why. It's never been clear why things follow this growth pattern, why it's so ubiquitous in nature. Understanding why, obviously, could be of tremendous importance because it would not only explain why dose density works, which is derived from the mathematics of Gompertzian growth, but it would also potentially give us some targets now that we have the ability to develop interventions based on targets that do things that are biologically important. I mean, it's an entirely different world of medicine now that we can couple finding targets with developing interventions. So it's really been on my mind for decades, and there's been no logical answer. The reason there's been no logical answer is because we've been taking the Gompertzian equation itself, the one that Benjamin Gompertz published in 1825, and trying to find the biological components of that, and it's been mysterious, and there's been no real answer. And we've looked, and I've written extensively about this search. Then I got a phone call from one of my collaborators, Joan Massagay, one of the best biological scientists in the world, in the National Academy and Hughes scholar and really a tremendously important person in the field of biomedical research. And he has been studying metastasis. One of the things that he did was he took human breast cancer, grew them in appropriate animal models, and found the ones that were going to the lung, took those cells out, reimplanted them in the mammary fat pad of the recipient mice, and with several iterations developed cell lines that had a high potential for lung metastasis, and the parental cell line had a low potential for lung metastasis. He also has bone and brain metastasis models built on a similar system. But in particular, with the lung metastasis model, he made an observation, and that is that the cell lines with a high probability of being metastatic to lung also grew very rapidly in the mammary fat pad in the primary site where they were implanted. But that the genes that were responsible, that could be identified, that were responsible for the lung metastases, the genes that were overexpressed in that line of cells compared to the parental line, were not genes that were associated with cell division or apoptosis, for that matter, cell loss. They were genes associated with matrix dissolution, with angiogenesis, with cell adhesion, and so on. And so it was somewhat mysterious to him. And he really called me to ask me, clinically, is it true that patients with metastatic disease do indeed have faster-growing tumors? And in fact, it's obviously true, as we find bigger cancers have a higher probability of metastatic spread, faster-growing cancers, and so on. But in that discussion, it became evident to us that one way of explaining this phenomenon was that the reason that the tumor was growing faster in the mammary fat pad was not that the cells were necessarily dividing more rapidly, but that they were metastasizing back to themselves. In other words, the cells would leave the mammary fat pad, some would go to lung, but some would go through the circulation and come back to the tumor where they came from.
It's mighty weird.
Do a return trip. But it's totally logical from a biological point of view because, after all, that organ is the organ they're most comfortable in. That's where they're growing in the first place. So, you know, a New Yorker can travel throughout the world but has a pretty high probability of returning to New York because that's the environment that the New Yorker is most comfortable in, for example. Maybe not the best example, but is an example that we can think about. And so from a biological point of view, it was just very, very logical. It would also explain a lot about cancer that right now is very mysterious. Why are cancers so disorganized histologically? Maybe they're disorganized because they're not one thing, but they are a collection of little things. In other words, little metastases. Maybe they're growing quickly because it's not one big mass, but it's a collection of little masses, and we know that little things grow faster than big things. That's the essence of Gompertzian growth, for example. May explain angiogenesis because each little tumor may require its own blood vessel to grow since it's somewhat independent of the other tumor cells, and therefore explains why you have increased vascularity in tumors, and so on. Indeed, invasiveness may not be invasiveness as we would think of it as spreading from the inside out, but rather evidence of metastases at the surface of the tumor and would have the same histological appearance. So he's actually done some experiments to confirm this, and those experiments are underway and, in fact, have been completed and are on the way to being published. The bottom line is we're convinced that this does indeed occur and that tumors attract their own metastatic cancers, particularly, or aggressive cancers, attract their own cells that go out into the circulation. And we've termed this self-seeding because it's reminiscent of the way weeds take over your garden. Now, a weed is not an oak tree that takes over your garden by growing so big. A weed takes over your garden by seeding other weed plants. Each weed plant is not particularly fast-growing, in fact, and each weed plant is not particularly large. It's not the weed that takes over your garden, it's the weed bed. It's the conglomerate of weeds that take over your garden, and they are invasive into normal plants in your garden, and they are metastatic because the same seeds that could fall in your garden can fall in your neighbor's garden. So thinking of a cancer as a weed bed rather than a large plant makes enormous sense. Now, what's especially interesting, and by the way, you could think of a lot of variants of this. For example, imagine that you have a tumor that is very good at seeding distant sites, but not very good at seeding itself. That tumor will extinguish in the primary site, and that could explain carcinoma of unknown primary, could explain spontaneous regression, like we see in melanoma on occasion, is that it's very good at seeding distant sites, but not good at seeding itself, and eventually will distinguish. It ties together closely with stem cell theory, because these seeds may indeed be stem cells, and that's why they are causing continued growth wherever they're found, because each one is a nidus of another little tumor focus. So there are a lot of mysteries. Pancreatic carcinoma, for example, doesn't form very much of a mass because it may have such a tendency to self-seed that it never really divides very much wherever a cell finds itself. It just keeps seeding.
And then presumably local recurrence then is seeding rather than local recurrence?
Exactly. And multifocality, like in breast cancer, where you find multifocality. Why do you need radiotherapy to the breast after you've removed the lump with negative margins? How could that happen? The margins are totally negative, and yet if you don't give radiotherapy, half or more patients are going to relapse in the breast. Why is that so? Because according to this theory, the cancer is actually metastasized to the breast. Now, from a therapeutic point of view, why this is fascinating is we essentially have no drugs to interfere with that process. However, that process should be a rich source of targets because the ability to migrate through the tissues, to break away from the primary tumor mass, to go into a blood vessel, to travel and survive in the blood vessel, to come out of the blood vessel, to re-anchor itself, to start to divide. Most of those molecules must be on the surface of the cell. These are all surface phenomena related to adhesion, related to polarity, related to trying to find an environment called a niche where it can grow and develop. So it may be that antibodies against cell surface molecules important in the process, or small molecules against cell surface molecules important in the process, all of these are potential areas for drug development. And so we've been speaking to a lot of folks in the field of drug development about identifying such targets and developing interventions. And it seems to be a very exciting field. The one thing I can tell for sure is I know the phenomenon does occur. How important the phenomena is, how it relates proportionally in terms of malignancy to other characteristics of cancer, that really remains to be determined. But that it does occur, self-seeding is a truth, and it is a potential target for intervention.
What about the actual mechanisms of metastatic disease? There has been a lot of research on that. Anything that's promising in terms of how metastasis actually develop?
Yeah, right now, obviously, most of the concentration is on anti-angiogenesis or new blood vessel formation, which can stop metastatic sites that also might be able to stop self-seeding. There's been some work with anti-matrix metalloproteinases, for example, that has not been so promising yet, but it might be because we had the wrong ones. Or what's more likely is we're going to have to use these drugs in combination, which everybody realizes is that combination therapy to stop a complex process is absolutely obligatory. And the other element, of course, is tumor heterogeneity, that cancers can become metastatic by a variety of mechanisms, and probably within any one tumor there are a variety of mechanisms, and that we are going to have to use combinations of approaches to attack that.
But in terms of this self-seeding thing, I mean, people basically die of metastatic disease, not usually the primary. Are you thinking that maybe there's some type of a cycle that you can break by having this self-seeding?
Actually, what we think is that the seeding of distant sites, the metastasis is not the primary problem. The primary problem is growth in metastatic sites. So if somebody has a shower of cancer cells to their entire body and each cell doesn't divide or divides two or three times and forms a little microscopic focus and never gets any larger than that, cancer would not be a problem. It is the growth in metastatic sites. And in fact, what we have to consider is the possibility that the growth in metastatic sites is also due to self-seeding in the metastatic sites. And the recent paper we published in Nature Medicine gives an illustration of this. Now, this is the part that as a biomathematician really fascinates me, is that if you hypothesize that self-seeding occurs, then self-seeding occurs from the outside in. In other words, things grow from the outside in. So you're dealing with a very simple example. The surface area of a mass is related to its diameter squared, whereas the volume of a mass is related to its diameter cubed. So if you're growing because of something coming from the outside in, then you're going to grow proportional to the diameter squared, but you're going to lose cells by spontaneous cell death related to the diameter cubed. That means the ratio of growth to death is going to drop over time, and that will give you the Gompertzian phenomenon. And in fact, what we published in the paper in Nature Medicine is an example where you can take this very simple hypothesis of self-seeding, and it generates an equation that gives you almost exactly the same shaped curve as the Gompertzian equation. I mean, it's so close, in fact, that when we sent it in, the reviewers said, you're only showing one curve, you're not showing two. So that had to make them two different colors to be able to distinguish them. That's how close the curves are together. So it's possible that Benjamin Gompertz got the shape of the curve right. He got the equation wrong. And the reason that we haven't been able to find characteristics of the equation, biochemical characteristics of the equation, is because we're chasing the wrong target. And that this new equation has in it a simple component related to seeding, a simple component related to cell division, and a simple component related to spontaneous cell death or apoptosis or other mechanisms. Just those three parameters plugged into the equation gives you Gompertzian curves. The last interesting thing to me about this that I want to mention is that if the hypothesis is true, and if the curve is an accurate representation of the growth of tumors, then we don't have to kill cancer cells necessarily to be able to cure patients. What we have to do is we have to affect those parameters so that each tumor doesn't grow very large. So increase the cell depth slightly or increase the geometry, the spatial arrangement of the cells on the periphery of the tumor where the growth occurs. I'm very encouraged by the experts in cancer stem cells who have assured me that they find cancer stem cells on the periphery of tumors, not in the core of tumors, colon cancer and breast cancer in particular where that's been shown. So that if we can somehow make these stem cells deposit themselves in the tumor in a more diffuse pattern rather than in such a dense pattern, that may be enough to be able to convert a malignant cancer to a benign mass. And this is something that might be very amenable to chemical intervention with monoclonal antibodies or small molecules or even vaccines. We right now are actively pursuing finding what the targets are that are responsible for these phenomena so then we can work with our colleagues in developing chemical intervention.
To what extent is this sort of out there and being discussed? I certainly haven't heard
anything. Well, I've been talking about it for a few years now as a hypothesis, sort of ill-formed, but we really have it presented in sufficiently sophisticated detail that people can start to think about it and start to think about what to do with it. It's in a recent publication in Nature Medicine.
And what kind of reaction are you getting to this? What kind of criticism?
I haven't gotten much in the way of criticism yet, frankly, which is nice, but that, of course, just means that it's a young theory. What I'm getting is exactly what I'd want to get, which is I'm getting a lot of interest in doing experiments to explore the phenomenon from really top scientists. We just recently in New York had our scientific and public meeting of the Breast Cancer Research Foundation. We have 115 scientists that are supported by that foundation, including some of the top people in the breast cancer field. And there was a lot of discussion. I had the opportunity to present this theory at a scientific symposium that we had a few days ago. And there was a lot of discussion about experiments that could be done and I hope will be done to explore the phenomenon. A lot of clinicians have come up to me, however, which is also extremely encouraging, have given me clinical examples where the theory makes sense, things that they have observed in the clinic, such as spontaneous regression, such as carcinoma of unknown primary. These are ideas that were really handed to me by clinicians who heard this, such as why ductal carcinoma in situ can look so malignant and be so benign. Clinicians with clinical experience have thought about this and have said it does explain mysteries that are in the clinic that might be explained by this.
You mentioned angiogenesis, and I'm curious what your take is in terms of the whole evolving bevacizumab story. It kind of seems like it's going in a direction that maybe we didn't expect in terms of what seems to be synergy with chemotherapy. You know, at this point, what's your take on all this?
I think the field is young. It reminds me a little bit, and I'll get a more specific answer in a second, but it reminds me a little bit of the very early days of adjuvant chemotherapy of breast cancer, where there were small trials, and there were a few of them, and we asked ourselves questions like, how come chemotherapy works in 4 to 9 positive nodes, but doesn't work in 10 or more, and doesn't work in 1 to 3? And you remember those days when
Sure.
we had little micro dissections of the data, and people came up with hypotheses and whatever, and the fact of the matter is, these were largely statistical artifacts in those days, and as we got larger, better drugs, better regimens, larger trials, a lot of that sorted out. I think that it's not quite the same, but with bevacizumab, the fact is that we don't have that many clinical studies and that much clinical experience yet, and that some of our issues and concerns are going to sort out really over time. I think it is logical and reasonable to me that an anti-angiogenesis therapy should work with a cytotoxic therapy, and I think it ties together very closely with the notion of self-seeding in my own mind. I can't help but be biased toward my own theory, is that the cancer is growing for two reasons. One, it's spreading to distant sites and to itself, and then once it spreads to distant sites and to itself, then the cells have to divide. If the cells went to an organ or went back to the breast itself, let's say, for breast cancer, and couldn't attract a blood vessel, it's not going to divide very many times, and it's not going to add very much to the growth of the tumor. Similarly, if it does go to that site, it's going to have to also divide by mechanisms controlling cell division. So that by attacking cell division, which is what chemotherapy largely does, and by attacking angiogenesis, we're attacking two components of the three-part model of self-seeding. The actual, not the movement of the cell to another site, but its ability to be nurtured by the environment there, and cell division. Now, what we have to do is we have to attack the other two processes that are in this, which is the mobility of the cell itself, and also its probability of undergoing spontaneous cell death or apoptosis or autophagy or other processes of cell death. In other words, we had a very simple model of cancer not too long ago. Cancers are bad because they divide too much. And now we have a much more sophisticated model involving processes such as mobility and angiogenesis and mitosis and apoptosis and absence of senescence and other characteristics that have been defined. But all of these have molecular determinants that, with the proper experiments, can be measured and can be specified. We can find the genes responsible for each of these components of the cancer process. And as we find them, we'll be able to develop interventions. So the notion of just poisoning cell division, which is what chemotherapy does, and attacking just one aspect of angiogenesis, which is the VEGF loop, is going to get much more sophisticated very, very quickly as we define other components of angiogenesis, components of cell mobility. What are the determinants? We only have one specific determinant of cell division, HER2, for example, that we attack right now. What are the specific determinants of cell division that can be attacked? And all of this is going to start to come together. I think an overarching theory, however, that pulls it all together could potentially be useful.
Which would be?
Self-seeding.
Wow. I have to start reading Nature Medicine more frequently. Getting back to bevacizumab, one of the interesting, I think, sort of unexpected ideas that's come out in the last couple of years is the idea of bevacizumab normalizing blood flow to improve delivery of chemotherapy, which is definitely not the way we started out thinking about this. What do you think about that?
I think that that's a topic that requires further exploration. I think it's a very tenable hypothesis, and I know that there's some data suggesting this might be the case. But it's a long step from showing that something is logical and feasible as an explanation to showing that it is the explanation for the phenomenon. I remember the old TV commercial with Michael Jordan doing fantastic things with the basketball. And whenever asked, he would say, you know, it's not the shoes. It was a shoe ad, obviously, a basketball shoe ad. Having good sneakers is very important to a basketball player, but it's not what makes a basketball player great. And so identifying something that is associated with the activity of an agent doesn't necessarily explain why that agent is doing what it's doing.
Any guesses or speculations about how Bev's going to do in the adjuvant setting, and how does that tie into the self-seeding thing?
Well, speculation is it should be studied. It's obviously bevacizumab and other anti-angiogenic agents should absolutely be studied in the adjuvant setting. In fact, if the self-seeding hypothesis is right, the earlier you use these agents, the more effective they're going to be, since the metastatic process is absolutely dependent on seeding. And in early breast cancer, when it's micrometastatic, that might be the absolute best time to intervene with the ability of seeds that have already spread to attract the blood supply. So that, if anything, self-seeding theory would suggest that anti-angiogenic therapy should be more active in the adjuvant setting than against advanced disease. We have a lot of questions that have to be asked in this regard, though. What is the proper combination with cytotoxic therapy? What is the proper duration of exposure? And what's the best agents to combine the drug with? We're only going to sort that out with clinical trials, but I hope that we'll be able to sort it out faster by the use of the neoadjuvant model. And that's certainly where most of the clinical investigation in this area is starting to lean. By using drugs like bevacizumab and appropriate chemotherapy with primary disease, we'll not only have access to tissue to be able to actually look at some of the biological parameters we're talking about, but we'll be able to screen agents more quickly and determine if they're active and which are the more active ones.
And that clearly is a huge trend right now. You have the NSABP B40 study that's going to look at that. What would you like to look at inside the tumor in these patients?
I want to look at it as much as I possibly can. I think that it would be a terrible mistake right now to restrict the questions that we ask. We don't know enough about the biology to know what to ask. We need access to the tissue. We need to process it right now with available tools, but we also need to save tissue as the molecular tools improve, and they are improving dramatically rapidly over this next period of time. One thing that we're not looking at enough, I think, is gene copy number and also mutations in key genes. Right now, our tools are very sophisticated for looking at expression, which genes are turned on by how much RNA is being produced. We have a lot of interest, obviously, in looking at the proteins, but right now, the tools for looking at proteins in general, it needs to be developed. We can look at specific proteins, obviously, and that's what we do all the time with immunohistochemistry. But one thing that we're very aware of is that cancers, breast cancers, all cancers, vary enormously in gene copy number, amplifications of genes, deletions of genes, and that could be extremely important, not just which genes are amplified and deleted, but patterns. Is it uniform randomly throughout the genome? Are there hotspots? Does this relate to DNA repair defects that may be in the cancer? Certainly BRCA1 and BRCA2 seem to be diseases of DNA repair defects. So gene copy number is very important. And also, the lessons we've learned with lung cancer and EGFR mutations, we haven't found those in breast cancer or HER2 mutations yet, but they probably are important mutations as well. And that's also got to be looked at. So there are a lot of really important questions that we need to address, not just DNA expression at the RNA level, but also some of these other issues. And we're not going to be able to ask all these questions right now, but what we can do is collect the specimens, treat the patients in uniform fashion, gather all the clinical data, and then keep our eyes open and reprocess the material as important scientific leads surface.
As you were talking, I was thinking about lung cancer and your colleagues down the hall, Mark Criss and Vince Miller, Tom Lynch, Dana-Farber, and that whole scene with the EGFR mutations, the non-smoking stuff. I mean, right. What's your take on that? It just, to me, it's fascinating. I don't know what it means, but it's fascinating.
I used to be very involved in music. And what it means is that if you're conducting an orchestra, your orchestra can sound bad for any one of 400 or 500 reasons. You know, any one instrument out of tune is going to make it bad, or coming in a measure too soon, or coming in a measure too late. Somebody playing too quickly, and somebody playing too slowly, somebody playing too loud, and somebody playing too softly. All of these can occur, and the orchestra can sound bad. So you can't say orchestras sound bad because the first violinist is out of tune. That's one reason, but there's lots of other reasons. And when we're dealing with cancer, we're dealing with very broad-based abnormalities, but they could be from a whole variety of sources. The big scientific question that we don't know the answer to is, does each individual cancer all by itself have its own abnormalities that are unique to it, or are there certain common pathways that all cancers follow, or a handful of pathways that cancers of, let's say, breast cancers, lung cancers follow, so that we can have a manageable number of agents, drugs, medications that we can use in that setting? I think we don't know the answer to that question yet. If it turns out that each cancer is its own orchestra with its own tonality problem, then immunological approaches are probably going to be the most important, using the body's immune system to attack cell surface molecules and cell-mediated immunity and so on, because that's about the only approach I can see is going to work on a systemic basis. My hope and also my anticipation is that there will be a finite number of pathways that will be found to be commonly abnormal in cancer, and that these will be definable and specific interventions will make sense because we'll be able to intervene anywhere in that pathway and get the desired result. At least that's the area of research that we're focusing in on. And clearly, the self-seeding hypothesis is going to be very important for guiding how we develop interventions in that regard.
Somehow this conversation made me think about an interview I did with Soon Paik a couple of weeks ago, where he was talking about c-MYC. And it sounded like, from the way he was describing it, that he had these thoughts that maybe somehow the c-MYC pathway might be common to a lot of tumors. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think, you know, Soon is a great investigator, and I think that I've seen the data, at least in a preliminary fashion, presented, and it really is very interesting. I know he's doing more work in trying to define this in larger number of samples. MYC is a very important molecule. But like other molecules I'm talking about, this is another characteristic, is most of the molecules that we know that are known to be associated with malignancy, HER2 would be another example, the cell adhesion molecules, other examples, affect more than one system. MYC is a very good example. They affect more than one system, cell division, apoptosis, adhesion, mobility, metabolism. They have a whole variety of biological effects. And that is very encouraging because it means that we may have a restricted number of targets we'll be able to develop interventions to, because the key molecules that go awry affect lots of processes, and it basically looks much more complicated than it is. You know, for example, if in an orchestra, if the conductor goes nuts, all the instruments can sound bad. And so you don't have to fix the instruments, you just have to fix the conductor.
I keep thinking I want to get into more practical stuff, but this stuff is so interesting. Let's pursue it a little bit more. And getting back to the self-seeding, are there implications in terms of prevention or at least preclinical prevention?
If the seeding hypothesis turns out to be true and turns out to be useful to us, the big question we're going to have to wrestle with is how does this develop? And why this may have a very important prevention aspect is that we know that there are normal processes in the human body that absolutely depend upon seeding. The clear example is inflammation or the immune response. If you cut yourself and a few bacteria get in, cells are mobilized all over your body. Your bone marrow pours out important cells that go to the site of the injury and are important for killing the bacteria, are important for starting the wound healing process, for laying down collagen, for growing new blood vessels. And these are all things that are coming in from a distant site to the area in question to augment what's happening locally in the healing process. So inflammation really is all about cell mobility. It's a normal process and it's all about that. And this is particularly intriguing because there's lots and lots of smoking gun evidence linking inflammation with cancer. Every prostate with cancer in it has evidence of acute or chronic inflammation. Commonly in breast cancer, we'll see evidence of inflammatory response in the breast or evidence of old inflammatory response like old scar tissue and sclerosis and that sort of thing. The association of chronic irritation and maybe even cigarette smoking as an example of that or thermal injury, chronic burns and cancer is because of chronic overstimulation of the immune response. What's particularly intriguing in this regard is that very recently there's been published a wound response signature, a gene expression profile signature, that is actually not measuring what's happening in the cancer cells, but what's happening in the cancer, which is a mixture of normal stromal cells and cancer. And that has very important prognostic information. The more inflammatory genes that are turned on, the worse the prognosis of the cancer, indicating the close link between inflammatory response and cancer. Of course, if the hypothesis is true, one of the things that links them is that these genes may all be associated with the ability of cells that are not normally, under normal circumstances, mobile, becoming mobile. In the inflammatory case, it's to go to an area to help them heal. And in the cancer case, it may be the etiology to the problem. So that since we know a lot about inflammation and knowing more all the time, and since we can do things to limit inflammation, perhaps we can do things chemically to limit the initiation of the cancerous process itself. Vaccination, for example, against key molecules that may be associated with abnormal cell mobility, maybe able to nip that process in the bud. And that's just one potential example. Clearly, we need much more to be able to even speculate wildly about this particular topic, but there is something intriguing there.
Let's talk a little bit about dose-dense therapy. Before we get into the practical issues, what about theoretically? How does what you've described in terms of dose density tie into the self-seeding thing?
Well, I think it ties into it because the concept of dose density derives strictly mathematically from the Gompertzian phenomenon. If you believe that cancers grow in a Gompertzian fashion and that they respond to therapy in a Gompertzian fashion, which means if they grow fast, they shrink fast. If they're growing slowly, they shrink more slowly, which is what the Norton-Simon hypothesis found. And again, there's been no counterexamples ever been found since it was published, so that it seems to be something, if it's not true, at least we haven't found a counterexample. But if you plug into your thinking Gompertzian growth and regression proportional to rate of growth, which is the Norton-Simon hypothesis, then dose density comes right out. It says your big problem is you got to kill cancer cells, but you got to come back in with another dose of therapy before they have a chance to regrow. That's all it's really all about. So you pick your best dose. That's the dose of drug that gives you optimal response. Going higher doesn't necessarily give you more response, and you give it as often as you can. So once you have a handle on Gompertzian growth, then the rest of it sort of flows naturally. The question is, what is the etiology of Gompertzian growth? And that's what we're working on. But there's something even more specific than that that I think has been shown to have clinical relevance. And that is, according to the mathematics that led to the idea of giving AC followed by Taxol every 2 weeks, according to that concept, what you want to do is you want to get your maximum anti-cancer effect and do it as often as possible. So we wrestled with the drug capecitabine in the treatment of metastatic disease. Widely utilized 14 days on and 7 days off, well known to cause real toxicities, and hardly anybody can use the drug at the doses that are specified in the approval process because of the toxicities, so that people reduce the dose of the drugs and maintain the 14-day cycle or have to curtail it by stopping after 10 or 11 or 12 days. And for that reason, the drug, which is a fantastically active drug, has probably not been as utilized as much as it should be for that particular reason. So in discussion with my colleagues at Roche, we designed some animal experiments to look at the growth curves of tumors in mice that were being treated with capecitabine, and fit the curves with the Gompertzian curves and with Norton-Simon Gompertzian type regression and just see what we can see. Now, one thing that Richard Simon and I observed many decades ago and was published in one of our earliest papers, I think in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, decades ago, was that if you give a continuous therapy, whether it's every day, every 6 hours, every 2 days, every 3 days, but on a continuous basis, and you look at not does the tumor shrink, but what is the rate of shrinkage compared to the rate of growth that that tumor would have if it were not treated with chemotherapy? What one finds is that if you give continuous therapy, you hit a point where that ratio is maximum, and then that ratio starts to drop. So that after a certain period of time, that the cancer is still shrinking, but it's not shrinking as fast as it was compared to what its spontaneous growth would be as it would at an earlier time. And what we found in the animal experiments is that with capecitabine, roughly around a week, it could be 6, 7, 8, 9 days, was the point where the ratio of the regression compared to its anticipated growth rate at that tumor size was maximum. You kept treating 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 days, the tumor continued to shrink, but it was actually shrinking more gradually than it was shrinking proportionally by day 7. So to optimize that schedule, what one has to do, the mathematics is very clear on this, is stop at day 7 and then come back in with another 7 days of therapy as soon as you can. That's the dose-dense concept. You pick your optimal dose and schedule, and you give it as often as you can. And so we explored in the animal systems 7 days on and 7 days off. And one thing that was remarkable is you could drive the dose level much higher. If you don't have to worry about the second week of therapy, you can put the dose level much higher. And that caused even more regression in doing so. So we had fantastic results in the animal systems. And based on that, Maria Theodoulou, Cliff Huddis, Tiffany Trainer at Memorial Sloan Kettering have been conducting a phase 1-2 trial of 7 days on and 7 days off. And frankly, the trial is still ongoing for a long time now because we can't reach maximum tolerated dose. And so we think we might be approaching it now, but we've gone much higher with the dose than we ever could have imagined. And our responses are terrific and toxicity is greatly minimized. It's just like we discovered with the use of Neupogen and now Neulasta with giving AC and paclitaxel every 2 weeks, that you got greater efficacy, but also less toxicity. So the 7 days on, 7 days off seems to be very efficacious, but in addition to that, it's less toxic than 14 days on and 7 days off, and that's based on the mathematical modeling. So that's really where dose density is going. We're actually going back to looking at the perturbation of animal tumors with various dose and schedules of chemotherapy and using that as a way of picking optimal dose and optimal schedule, even of agents that have been widely utilized.
So are we moving towards adjuvant dose-dense AC paclitaxel followed by capecitabine?
Certainly people are talking about that now, and especially in the setting of preoperative AC followed by T dose-dense, because not everybody's going to have a pathological complete remission. So the question is, if indeed you give dose-dense AC followed by T and you don't get a pathological complete remission, and you get a pretty high rate of pathological complete remission, by the way, by doing this, but if you don't, then you have residual cells that are probably resistant to those agents, and therefore dose-dense capecitabine at that point would be a very reasonable idea. We're also looking at combinations of dose-dense capecitabine with antivascular agents, Avastin being an example, as well as anti-HER2 agents.
What about in the actual adjuvant setting? You need to do the neoadjuvant first?
It really looks like we're going to be able to get our answers faster with the neoadjuvant approach. But if it's going to work in the neoadjuvant setting, it's going to work in the adjuvant setting. And that's one of the great things that we've learned by our research as a community in the last few years, is that if it works adjuvant, it'll work neoadjuvant. If it works neoadjuvant, it'll work adjuvant. I think eventually, once we have improved regimens, perhaps chosen because of their activity in the neoadjuvant setting, we can use them neoadjuvant or postoperatively and get the same benefit.
You mentioned the toxicity issue with dose-dense, and you've been saying that for a long time. And one of the things that I found interesting is the people who've used dose-dense AC paclitaxel, and a lot of them are participating in the CALGB trial, which looks at dose-dense AC without a taxane
right,
and
right.
dose-dense paclitaxel without AC. just because of the observations they're making of how well patients tolerate it, are switching over to dose-dense AZ with atataxane, for example, in node-negative patients. Yeah. What are your thoughts about
that? I think the principles hold. I mean, obviously, if AC-followed by T dose-dense is less toxic, so is AC going to be less toxic, and so is dose-dense T going to be less toxic. That's, I think, something very important to emphasize, is the fact is that we saw in 9741, and continued experience is confirming, that dose-dense therapy is less toxic as well as being more active. The other thing that I tell clinicians on this is that if you start off dose-dense and you run into a problem, you could always convert it to a Q3-week regimen. You've lost nothing in doing so. But if you start off dose-dense and the patient's tolerating it well, as most do, then you're giving the patient a tremendous advantage because you're over with the treatment that much sooner.
I'm going to ask you a question. I remember asking you the day the dose-dense data first came out in San Antonio a few years ago, which I'm not sure we have an answer to yet, is that how do we know that this isn't all about the scheduling of paclitaxel?
Well,
i.e. weekly paclitaxel.
Yeah. I didn't have an answer back then, and I think we don't have all the answers now, but I have two answers. One is, who cares? Because, you know, if the therapy is over one-third sooner, and in addition to that, you get greater efficacy of the total regimen, and in addition to that, it's less toxic, why not? You know, why would somebody carefully choose your case to give them a more toxic regimen? So I don't know, from a practical point of view, why it's so important to answer that question. But the other answer is we have much more experience in preoperative dose-dense therapy now. And it's anecdotal, certainly at this point, although obviously we have trials that are running. But that from the response of primary tumors, which we can see and measure and feel and assess during the AC part, we can clearly see very, very dramatic rates of shrinkage during the AC part by doing that. And that clearly indicates in my own mind that the dose-dense AC is also doing something very important.
Do you think that dose-dense AC paclitaxel is a reasonable non-protocol neoadjuvant option right now?
Absolutely. I see no reason why you wouldn't want to do that. More effective in the adjuvant setting, so every reason to believe it's going to be more effective in the neoadjuvant setting. And in addition to that, it's less toxic. Why not?
Where are we right now with dose-dense AC paclitaxel trastuzumab?
Chow Dang in our program has completed a study. We're still following the very last patient out far enough to be able to publish definitive results, but certainly we have presented several times now very mature preliminary results. The major observation we've made there is that cardiotoxicity is extremely acceptable. In fact, we're certainly, without question, not seeing any more cardiotoxicity with that than we've seen with the non-dose-dense use of these agents.
I mean, can you say you have like 70
patients? Exactly. We very well might be seeing less cardiotoxicity by giving the dose-dense therapy as we're doing that we saw before. And the reason for that is very simple. If you look at 9741 and read the paper, you'll see that dose-dense AC was less cardiotoxic than Q3-week AC. And so if the chemotherapy itself is less cardiotoxic, then the additional incremental impact of trastuzumab would be less as well.
When you say it's less cardiotoxic, I mean, is that, you know, statistically significant?
It is.
Where has that been presented?
Well, in 9740, frankly, I don't know what the p-value was on that, but you can say definitively it is not more cardiotoxic, and that can be said very clearly, but it actually looks like it's less cardiotoxic. Whether it reaches statistical significance or not, I don't know, but the caveat there is we're dealing with a very small number of events. So
sure.
It would take an enormous accrual of patients to be able to get even a significant result into the p-value significant range.
So I take it, like your colleague Cliff Huddis, you are positioning dose-dense AC paclitaxel trastuzumab as maybe our best choice right now?
Right now, that is our standard of care for HER2-positive adjuvant breast cancer therapy.